Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Orion's March, performed by the Royal Scottish National Orchestra and composed by Patrick Moore. All the music you'll hear in this programme is composed by Patrick Moore, and indeed the xylophone tracks are played by Patrick Moore. By the way, he's an astronomer too. Yes, that Patrick Moore. Sir Patrick Moore, who's been presenting The Sky at Night on BBC television for an incredible 45 years. Last September, I visited Sir Patrick in his home in Selsey, a village on the Sussex coast. Just wanted to have a chat with him about his life as a stargazer. Patrick's home is a lovely old house called Farthings. I fancifully thought, what a lovely name for the home of someone who studies distant planets, Farthings. But Patrick hasn't a clue where the name came from. Someone did tell him that the house was once owned by a Mr. Penny, who had four sons, hence Farthings. But Patrick doesn't believe that either. Whatever about the source of Farthings, Patrick Moore is very much a Sussex man.
I've lived here over 30 years. I lived in Sussex almost all my life, apart from 3 years in Armagh, and not counting the war when I was flying all over the place. But I lived in this house since 1967, and I wouldn't move for anything.
So you're a Sussex man, basically.
I'm not actually Sussex born. I was born in Middlesex, but apart from the first 6 months of my life and the war and Armagh, I've always lived in Sussex.
Tell me a little bit about your background, your parents.
My father was an army officer. I think he would have been a general, but he went through the First World War, collecting the MC in the process, and also got very badly gassed, never really fit afterwards. He died some time ago now, in 1947. My mother, who I'm very close to, she was trained as a singer in Italy before the First World War under Sabatini and Carucci, and before she finished her training, was offered a lead in Italian Grand Opera. But she came back, married my father, an army officer, and never actually did it, but said that was her career. Also a very fine artist. And she and I were very close. I didn't marry. My girl was killed in the war, and therefore I didn't marry. And I was very close to my mother, and she was with me until she died in 1981.
And you had a girlfriend whom you obviously would have married, you think?
Almost no question about it, but the late hair hit, I had other ideas.
Ah, very sad. Now, do you inherit some of the musical side of your talents from your mother, then, you suspect?
Yes, quite definitely. Her family were all very musical, and I say she was a singer. My aunt was a very fine pianist. My uncle was also a very fine actor. And it comes from that side, definitely. I've never had any musical training at all. I mean, I've written quite a lot of stuff. The last thing I wrote, I may say, almost the last thing I write, was a march for the band of the Royal Paratroop Brigade called Out of the Sky. They wanted me to write a march, so I did. And I played the xylophone in the Royal Command performance once, so I've done quite a bit of it. I've had a CD out and a tape. And my main weakness now, last October, my vicious spine crumbled on me. It goes back to the war, really, and it means it's a handicap in my hand, and I can't now play the piano or the xylophone. And that, to me, is really a very great grief. Whether I ever will again, I don't know. I'm hoping, but it doesn't look good.
Well, hopefully, maybe you will. You had a lot of illness yourself as a child.
I did. My education was very badly knocked around. I was due to go to Eton and Cambridge, and never made either. I took Common Eds for Eton by having been ill, passed it, back in bed again by the cropped heart, never made it. I got my school exams externally, had my Cambridge place ready, then the war broke out, and I could get around like that. So I said I was 18, they believed me, and I went into the RAF and flew. That finished Cambridge.
So you had very patchy kind of formal education.
Very patchy indeed. I'm not self-educated. I got all my school exams correctly. So I passed Common Entrance, but I got my school certificate matric, equivalent to O&A levels, and just started risking to start on my degree. I wanted to say the war came along. That was my fault. I could have gone, but frankly, I had to bluff my way into the RAF because I was underage and I wasn't fit either, but I got in anyway.
But it was as a child, and I think when at one of the times you were ill, that you picked up this interest that you've had all your life now in the stars.
I remember, we're here, we can see over there an armchair. In that armchair, I was sitting when I was 6 years old in 1929, and by was a bookcase. My mother was a bit interested in this kind of thing, had a few books there. I pulled out a book called The Story of the Solar System, that I still have, sat there in that chair, and read it from cover to cover. It wasn't actually a boy's book, but my reading was all right, and I wouldn't be hooked out of that chair till I finished it. And it all went on from there.
Mm. And at what stage did you acquire a telescope, or had you one already?
No. I did the right thing, borrowed binoculars, and finally I saved up and bought a telescope, but I still have a 3-inch refractor. It cost £7.10. I had that when I was 11 years old. It's a very nice telescope. In fact, my first paper was published with that.
Mm. And did your mother encourage this, apart from having the book lying around?
Oh, very much so. She most definitely did. I mean, she was not wildly interested. I said, just have a few books about it, and it came from there. I just picked that particular book up.
Mm. And where did you eventually... Was it after the war that you picked up the pursuit of astronomy as such?
No. In fact, I say I got interested at a very early stage. Had a bit of luck. A friend of the family was a member of the British Astronomical Association. And at the age of 11, I was elected a member. I was the youngest ever member of the BAA. And I remember it well, and I went to have big greeted as a member. And exactly 50 years later to the day, I was president. Mm. I'm still now honorary life president.
Well done. And how did you manage to be elected at 11? Was this through poll, more or less?
No. The point is this. In the BAA, which is mainly amateur, there's no actual official age limit. I was the youngest, certainly, but they knew I was interested and were quite happy about this. I think probably still I'm the youngest, I'm not sure, but there's no formal qualification there. For the Royal Astronomical Society, there is, of course. That came much later.
And what avenues did that open to you to become a member of the BAA?
Well, I got interested straight away, and I had my little telescope. I began looking at the moon. I published my first paper, actually, my first research paper, when I was 14. Mm-hmm. I still got that paper. I went on from there. But I say, I intended, of course, to take my science degree, but say the war came along, I say I went to the RAF instead, and when I came out at the end of the war, I had been a bit knocked around, obviously, all we all are. I still had my Cambridge place, but it would have meant taking a government grant. That I wouldn't do. I prefer to stand on my own feet, so I thought I would pay my own way through. I wrote a book that caught on, another one that caught on. I never had time, so I have 8 honorary degrees, no honorary.
And the book was obviously a book on the planets and the stars.
The Moon, called Guide to the Moon. It's just come out again, called Patrick Moore on the Moon. Came out again earlier on this year, and I think it's 14th edition. Not much of the original left, believe me. And they went out in the 1940s, don't forget. Yeah. Yes, it came out this year.
We've learned a lot since then.
It's actually Castle publishing one this year. I'm very glad they did.
Just briefly, a little bit of your war experiences. As you say, you were knocked about a bit.
Oh, well, I was the flyer of bomber commands a long time ago now. So I hope we don't have to go through that again. Well, I must say, at the moment, we fought the Nazi Germans, the fascist Italians, and the Vichy French all at once and beat the lot, and they're now trying to send us over to those same people. No way.
You are not a European, Captain.
You could say that.
The moon, obviously, is, as you say, your favourite topic. You've made an extraordinary study of the moon.
Well, I've been one of the NASA moon mappers. I think they're my early interest, and still is. I'm still regarded astronomically as a moon man. I think probably because it was the first thing I ever really saw through a telescope. This is absolutely fantastic. And, of course, with a fairly small telescope, you can see a great deal of the moon. And I was just hooked on it. Difficult to say just why. I simply was. I see the moon being my main subject ever since.
And you ultimately went on to, as you say, to map it.
I was one of a very big team, certainly. And you know, the moon keeps the same face turned towards us all the time. The edge, therefore, was very foreshortened. And my job there was going around trying to map the moon's edge, which I did. And I say we got it fairly right, I think. Now, of course, we have maps of the entire moon for spacecraft. And all the work I did then is now obsolete. But it had to be done at the time.
It was quite a difficult task, I presume, given the knowledge you had then.
It was quite difficult, believe me. I say the other side of the moon was totally unknown. We had to try and cue it in. And I was very glad when the Russians got the first pictures back of the moon's far side from a spacecraft in 1959, they did use my charts to map up the near and the far sides, and I think I got most of it right.
And how does one actually map a body so far away in terms of scale?
Oh, the moon's close. The moon's a mere quarter of a billion miles right on our doorstep. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, what we were doing, we were photographing and actually observing, filling in details, and taking what advantage we could. You got most of it right.
And what did you find out about the moon? I mean, it's full of these what are called seas, but they're not.
The seas are not seas. I mean, there's no water there. Never has been. The moon's been airless and waterless, and the seas are old lava plains, and the craters there, we now know, were made by meteoric impact, things hitting the moon from outer space, and the moon was covered with craters. We are mapping those. Point being, you see, when the idea came of sending probes there, men there, obviously, you've got to have the best maps you can. There were a very large teams were doing that, and I was a very junior member of it. A very junior member, I can assure you.
You make the point, of course, when you're talking about the moon, we should, I suppose, have begun with the planet we are on, that in the scheme of things, this lump of rock we're sitting on is really not a very important.
It's totally unimportant. One sand grain of the Sahara. Oh, no, we're not important. Neither is our sun, neither is our galaxy. We are a very unimportant part of the universe, but very important to ourselves. I'm sure there's plenty of life up there, but it's a long, long way away, and whether we'll ever contact it, I know not.
And you say neither is our sun or our galaxy important?
Oh, no. Our galaxy, 100,000 million stars. We can see 1,000 million galaxies. Some of them are much larger than ours. So we're very unimportant even on that scale.
This to the layperson like me, this is what I find almost incomprehensible or unimaginable. I remember you reading somewhere where you said if you represent the distance from sun to Earth as an inch...
The nearest star, 4 miles away. Miles away, yes, and that... And the Andromeda galaxy would be 2 million miles away.
I mean, does that ever cease to amaze you?
You can't take it in. Nobody can do so. I mean, we merely accept these figures, but nobody can understand them. I mean, I can't imagine even 1 million miles. I don't know if you can. I certainly can't. I can't imagine it. I mean, the sun is 93 million miles away, and that's astronomically very close, but I can't picture it. I don't think anybody can.
Does this affect your thinking on creation or religion or whatever, the vastness of it?
There are three things I never discuss in public: football, politics, and religion.
All right. Point taken.
I'm a mere cricketer, don't forget. spin bowler.
And not no mean one, I'm told.
Ah, well, because I can't play now. Mm. Oh, I've enjoyed my cricket. Mm. I never played serious cricket. My bowling was standard, but I'm no batsman. I'm a poor field, but I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
Mm. You took 9 wickets one time in a match, did you?
I got 9 wickets 3 times. I never got all 10. Mm. Let's say that. My ambition is to get all 10 in innings. I got 9 3 times, and to make 100 runs in a season, which I never achieved. Betting at the Dizzy Heights of number 11.
Well, you can't have everything. You can't have everything. Just talk to me again about this unimportant son, so. I mean, what do we know about the sun?
We know a great deal about the sun now. We know, for example, how it's shining. It's not burning in the matter of a coal fire. It's using nuclear energy. And, of course, it's losing weight. Listen. Between those two claps on my hand, the sun lost 4 million tons. So the sun weighs a good deal less now than it did when we started talking today. But don't worry, there's plenty left. It'll go on for several thousand million years yet, so don't panic.
I'm relieved to hear that. Panic, huh? And in terms of its heat, its temperature?
Well, the surface temperature, below 6,000 degrees, but near the middle, where it's energy being produced, roughly 15 million degrees. Quite inconceivable. And that's where the sun is producing its energy.
And what it is, it's not solid, it's basically gas, isn't it?
It's gas, but very, very dense in the middle. It is critical energy by nuclear transformations. Inside the sun, there's a great deal of hydrogen. And in the middle there, hydrogen is banging together to build up atoms of a gas called helium. It takes 4 bits of hydrogen to make 1 bit of helium. Every time that happens, a little energy is set free, a little weight's lost. It's that energy that makes the sun shine.
And if it didn't, well, we wouldn't be around.
Well, but for that, he wouldn't have been here. After all, the Earth was formed about 4,500 million years ago from a cloud of material around the young sun, so but for the sun, we wouldn't be here at all. We know the Earth was formed about 4,500 million years ago. I was away at the time.
Were you bowling, batting at number 11 at the time, maybe? And this is, you're subscribed to the Big Bang theory?
So far as I can see, yes. Remember, I'm not a cosmologist, I'm a lunar mapper, but all the evidence indicates that way. But again, you see, we're stuck. If the Big Bang happened, well, what happened before that? There was no before. Time began at the same moment. And you can't put that into words. Otherwise, you've got to go back infinitely. You can't do that either. And no one can put that into plain English. Even Einstein couldn't, and I know because I asked him.
Well, I'll come back to Einstein and others in a moment. But you did this, the Earth's beginning, what was it, 4.5?
4,500 million years ago.
This is through radio carbon.
All kinds of avenues of research. They all lead to the same thing. I mean, give or take a few million years either way.
There was a wonderful quote from an instance you cited in one of your books before by Archbishop Usher in 1654,
yes,
who claimed the world began at 9 a.m. on the 26th of October, 4004 BC.
Summertime, I wonder. he added up the age of the patriarchs and made other totally irrelevant calculations. People accepted that for some time.
Mars, they think, will be the next planet to be explored.
I think Mars must be the next. It's less unlike the Earth than any other world. It's fairly close to us on the Earth's astronomical scale. And really, the only world we should be close to that's even possible. I mean, Venus is closer, but quite hopeless. So is Mercury. And beyond that, the Earth finds too cold. So it's got to be Mars, I think. And if all goes well, I think we may have Martian bases by the air war in about 20 or 30 years' time. Mm. I think it's got to be Mars.
Will we meet Martians?
I fear not. No little green men. Maybe some life there. Very primitive single-celled things, but nothing to advance as a blade of grass. No Martians, I'm afraid. I'd like to meet them. I'm sure they're not there. Mm. No canals, either.
And you described Venus as a disaster, is it?
Quite hopeless. About the same size as the Earth, but on the other hand, the surface temperature is nearly 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The atmospheric pressure is about 90 times the pressure in this room now. The atmosphere is made up chiefly of choking carbon dioxide, and the clouds are rich in sulfuric acid. Therefore, go there. You'll be fried, poisoned, squashed, and corroded, and I don't recommend it.
You certainly wouldn't hit 100 runs there.
I certainly wouldn't.
So, I mean, and you say the further we go, then Mercury and beyond, the more hostile the environment.
Mercury is quite hopeless, no atmosphere there, very near the sun. And beyond, the giant planets, Jupiter and Saturn, well, they're made up of gas. They're gaseous planets, and they're very, very cold and very massive. So I think in our solar system, the only world we can really colonise at the moment are the Moon and Mars. Jupiter has got some big satellites. Saturn has one. Eventually it might be so, but it's too far. Now, in our own time, I think Mars is the only possibility.
Hmm. Why should we bother, though, then? Why should we even bother in trying to land on Mars?
We don't know what we're going to find there. Remember, I think it was Faraday who said, when asked about this newfangled science of electricity, what's good at it? He said, well, madam, what's the good of a newborn baby?
Touché. Now, you said earlier in the interview that we think, I suppose, as I said, well, the Earth is very important to us, and then all these planets, which are millions and millions and miles away from us, but yet they are equally unimportant in the vast scale of things.
They are indeed. After all, say, 100,000 million stars in our galaxy, we can see 1,000 million galaxies. That's only part of them, so we're a very, very tiny thing. We can't comprehend the scale of the universe at all. It's bigger than we can possibly conceive.
And at the same time, space is very sparsely populated.
Well, in a way it is. There are plenty there, but space is very big, don't forget. Please say, how big is space? Well, how do you answer that one? Either space is finite, or else it's not. If it's finite, then what's outside it? Say nothing, it's merely begging the question. If it's infinite, well, then something goes on forever, and you can't do it. Therefore, it's a hopeless question. It's a multi-dimensional question, and I'm a three-dimensional creature, which is another way of saying I haven't a clue.
And so it's very unlikely then that there would be any great major collisions if there's that much room out there and so few heavenly bodies.
Certainly our Earth could be hit. Going around the sun, there are things called meteoroids, asteroids and comets, and we could be hit. And there's fair evidence that about 65 million years ago, we were hit by a fairly large thing. There was so much dust, it changed the climate and wiped out the dinosaurs, and that could happen. We are not immune. We could be hit by something, no question about that.
Earlier on also you mentioned that you had spoken with Einstein.
Yes.
What are your memories of him?
I met him only once. It was in early 1940. I joined the RAF, I must admit I was underage, and went out to learn how to fly, and they trained us in Canada. I went down to New York on a week's leave there, invited to a scientific thing, and I met Einstein there for one and only time. I'm very glad I did. Mm. Fascinating man. Quite unworldly, just as you would imagine him, I think. Mm. And, of course, the greatest brains in Newton, I suppose.
Who, for you, then, are the great brains or the great discoverers of that have helped to build up the picture of the planets that we have?
You mean now or in past time?
Well, both.
Well, obviously Newton, obviously Halley, I think, obviously, in our modern times, Einstein, and the great observers, Herschel, Bradley, and so on. There are plenty of them.
And has any particular one influenced you more than others?
In my own time, those I've met, you mean? Mm. Difficult to say. I think, looking back in history, the man I'd like to have met was Edmund Halley of Comet fame, the second astronomer royal, a very jovial kind of person. I think he did a great deal of work. And his last act on Earth was to call for a glass of wine and drink it.
Admirable. Was he a cricketer? To your best of your knowledge?
Well, he died in 1742, a little before cricket. Oh. Just about starting then.
Thank you.
Now, Patrick, we've made a slight detour to your little observatory here. Tell us what you have here with you.
Well, this is what's called a 15-inch reflector. The main mirror is 15 inches across. As you can see, it looks old-fashioned. It's not, in fact. It just suits me. Wouldn't suit people like Owen at all, his astrophysicist, but I'm a lunar clarity observer, and it's just right for me. And I've made many observations with this.
How much time do you spend here?
Well, when I was able to, up to last year, well, a great deal. I had moon and planets every night of the first, but now it's much more difficult, unfortunately.
Now, to the layman, can you explain exactly what...
I can.
What is here? What can we can see?
As you can see, it's a wooden cube. At the bottom there is a mirror. Mm-hmm. That mirror is 15 inches across. The light goes down the tube and strikes that mirror. The reflector back up the tube onto a second mirror, which is here, deflects into the side here, lets you put your eye or your camera. Look there and you'll see what's through there. You see what I mean? Look through there.
Oh, you look through here.
And you see what I mean. You put your eye or your camera.
Oh, yes. Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, very ordinary, very conventional telescope, called a Newtonian, designed first made by Sir Isaac Newton. And it works very well. It's got a drive, of course. And this is just suited for my kind of work.
Yeah, see, in my innocence, my ignorance, I would have thought you'd look through the other end of the telescope.
Well, my second telescope, you do. This is what's called a reflector, which is used in mirrors, not lenses. Hmm. This is a reflecting telescope, say a Newtonian. And that's how it works. It's driven, of course, it follows the sky, with the motor that drives it round. And there you are, it's a very
good.
And
it has just this aperture in your little... observatory here. I mean, is that a fixed aperture? You...
Oh no! At the end, you open the roof up there, the windows there, and the entire thing goes round. Listen.
Open it up for me there. Do I see?
Open up the roof there. Well, I won't admit that I was just blizzarding, but that's how you look at the peak sky.
So you
and
can
keep any part of the sky.
You can look at any part of the sky you want.
I wonder how many hours I spent at this telescope. I hate to think.
Yeah. It's called Fullerscopes?
No. The mirror was... I know one knows the main mirror. We figure by a very well-known man named George Hill. The mounting made by Peter Sartori. And I went to Dudley Fuller, Fullerscopes. I wanted a massive mounting for it. And he had this one, which just fitted. So he put that on for me. And it works very well.
So it was just tailor-made for your needs.
It actually was. It was sheer luck.
Yeah. And you could literally sit here all night looking at the
sky. I've done that many times, yes, rather. I said, yeah, a lot of observation, but at the moment I'm afraid it's come to an end.
And what would have been some of the exciting moments you've spent here?
I was mapping the moon with this, found the editing there, observing Mars, the dust storms upon Mars, the spots on Saturn. I'm essentially a planet man. Some of the variable stars, because in my own land, I observe because they wanted. I get down to a low magnitude, but mainly moon and planets.
And how clearly can you see the moon's surface?
You get a magnitude of 800 or 900 on this, you can look right into the moon. Mm. And see on Mars, you the ice caps, the red deserts, the clouds, the shifting markings there. Or due to the belts, the spots, the satellites. It's pretty good.
This is all in Patrick's back garden in Celsey, I have to say. Assisted by his protege, Owen.
Now, through here we have a second telescope. Mm-hmm. This is a refractor. A much smaller one, but it's a very good one. And this one looks new and isn't. The one that I've seen looks old and isn't. This one looks new and isn't. Made by the lens made by a man named Cook, who died long, long ago, but made the best lenses ever.
Yeah, seems to depend a lot on old things.
The other telescope is not old.
No,
it looks. You're working better one now. Right. This is a refractor, and this time the entire roof comes off, which I won't do now, since it's drizzling.
Perspex roof slides off. Yes.
This is the 5-inch. It's a very good one.
And relative to the other one?
Quite different. This is a refractor, not so powerful. If you want to project the sun and observe the sun's orbit, you would never look direct, of course. This is the one to do it with. That's hence the silver screen there.
Hmm. Well, you've got a weather vane, yeah? Tell me about the weather vane.
Oh, rather nice, isn't it?
Yeah, in your roof.
a little
yes, well, good.
Figure on a, looking through a telescope.
Yes.
As well as the north, south, east, west.
Solar panels in the roof. Mm. Other telescopes around here. There's one in there, the 8.5 inch. See, well, the other one about half size. And finally, my dear old 12.5 inch over here. My first big telescope that I had immediately at the end of the war. Over here, in the runoff shed.
Mm.
I did a lot of my early work with that.
So you have four in all out in the garden?
Yes.
You can't really miss, can you, between them all?
Not really. These are the weather things, and they're also the local weather station. Mm. I'm stationed 53 north, 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 77 north, sending my daily weather records.
Every day?
Yes. Take the week at 9 o'clock each morning.
Mm.
And here I find that it's 12.5 inch.
Quite impressive. And what would you use this for?
Well, that was the first big telescope I had. Mm. I did my early moon mapping with that. I wanted something a bit bigger, so I got the 15-inch. Mm. I've got a great affection for this one.
So you still use them all?
Oh, yeah. Well, I used to, until this happened. There's a sundial there. That's my trade union sundial. It goes on strike for 6 months of the year when the sun goes south of the equator.
Yeah, well, it would, wouldn't it? Yeah. You've spent a long lifetime now exploring and studying the planets and writing about them. You have a new book just out, The Star of Bethlehem.
Yes, so down here, we're setting up a major planetarium, the South Downs Planetarium, and we're doing a Christmas show. We're doing about the Star of Bethlehem, and we'll have a look at this. So I've done a little book on it, and various other people have too. What it was, we don't know, if anything, and how. But a little book, anyhow, we'll see how it's how it goes.
Mm. And I haven't had the chance to see it yet, but is it a fanciful story, or is it
no,
a scientific...
It's an attempt to say, if there's any truth in the story of the Star of Bethlehem, if it's not just a nice story, can we explain it scientifically? And I've looked at the various possibilities.
And briefly, what are they?
Well, in my view is, it must have been something that was brilliant, short-lived, seen there by a few people, unexplained. My guess is it must have been possibly a couple of very bright meteors going in the same direction. But of course, that doesn't give the whole story by any means, but it's the best I can think of.
Mm. When I heard you talking earlier about when this would have happened, was just between, 2 and 4 BC?
BC 4 and BC 7.
BC 4 and BC 7, that's when Jesus was born.
Yes.
And it wasn't a... Is there any possibility it was any kind of supernatural thing, or was it just a happening of a couple
of
meters?
As I said when I began the book, I'm not going down that road at all. I'm saying, if there is anything there, what was it?
Mm. And it wasn't a conjunction of planets as such?
Everyone would have seen it. Mm. After all, Hedron there had to go and look. And if the wise men were taken in by that, they wouldn't have been very wise.
Right. So... as I say, you've been studying and still writing about these the planets and stars and the moon particularly. What is it that drives you on that you don't even think of retiring? If that's
I think we're at the wish to find out. And after what do I retire from? I've never worked in my life. My work and my hobby are the same things. I never really worked. And now why should I retire? I can retire from.
Hmm.
I don't want to. I'm doing my Sky at Night now for. Well, if next April I have my 45th anniversary, and I want to go on as long as I can, as long as they want me to.
Which is, I think, is a record, isn't it? You're in the Guinness Book of Records.
Oh, it's had me for years. Yeah. I've been there 3 times. I also sent the slowest inland telegram in history. You know, here to Sittleton, which is 4 miles, it took 3 months. And I beat my ideally sent one from Bolton to Oldham. It took 4 years, because there are no telegrams now, so I can't get that one back.
Was this a deliberate attempt to get into the Guinness Book of Records?
Not no. Off it.
Took 3 months to go, what was it, 4 miles?
Yes.
4 miles. So you obviously, and as you say, this is not your work at all, it is your hobby. What can you say to someone like me? I mean, it's the kind of thing I'd love to take up maybe in retirement to study the stars a bit more, to someone starting out or to a young child like you were at 6 years of age.
That's what I did. First thing, do some reading and get the general background. That's the first thing to do. Then don't go for a telescope. Go out at night and learn your way around the sky. It doesn't take long. The stars don't move compared with each other. Learn your way around the sky. And then invest in a pair of binoculars and have a look around. If you're still interested then, think about a telescope. But meanwhile, join an astronomical society. And there are plenty of them now. There are plenty here and in Ireland too. There are two very good ones in Ireland. Mm. So certainly I should join that. Ride it anyway, and go on from there. And of course, as an amateur, you don't need any definite qualifications, and you can spend as much or as little time on it as you like. And amateurs can and do very useful work. Of course, professional, you must take a degree. So that's another story.
Mm. But of course, also, you're. This is probably one of the attractions of living in a place like Celsey. I mean, if you live in a big city, it's very difficult to study the stars. The light pollution
really is becoming a menace now. No question about it. As I say, the only answer then is either a portable telescope or going to the countryside.
Now, you mentioned how you still have the first telescope that you ever got. You also have out in your wonderfully cluttered study two things that caught my eye, a cuckoo clock and a typewriter.
The cuckoo clock was my sixth birthday present. My mother said, "What do you want for birthday?" I said, "Mummy, I would so like a cuckoo clock." In our little car, we drove to London. We parked in Oxford Street. We bought the clock, I think it was 30 shillings, drove further down, parked again, had tea and came home. Wouldn't be very popular now. The typewriter, I acquired that when I was 8 years old. I'd had my grandfather 1892 winning, so I still got. This one here was acquired when I was 8 years old. Now, at that stage, my Bible was Pickering's book about the moon. Totally unattainable, punched many on a year, couldn't get it. But I wanted that book, and I wanted it badly. I couldn't get it. And a friend of ours, a fellow of the RAS, and borrowed that book. And I had this 60,000-word book in my possession for 3 months. And I remember thinking in my 8-year-old way, now, if I type this book out, I'll have the book I want. I'll be able to type, and I'll be able to spell. And it worked like a charm. I began ding, ding. But then I was touch typing, and I've got that book now.
Do you still have the manuscript you typed?
I have indeed.
Yeah. How long did it take you?
Well, when I started very slowly, you see, but by the end I was touch typing. It didn't take all that long when I got into it. Mm. But I still type with two fingers. But I say, before my hand went, I typed accurately at 90 words a minute. Not so good now, unfortunately. Mm.
It's a wonderful story. And anything else out there that we should know about that's been there almost as long as yourself?
The typewriter, certainly. The cuckoo clock, certainly. My desk I acquired fairly early when I was a boy. I remember that one, too. Mm. But those are the main things, I think. Some of the books, of course. Was when I found my first book, I went down to the second-hand shop and spent my 6 months pocket money on another book. I got that, and I still got that one, too. So it accumulated from there, really. Yeah. And also, when I was about nine, or less now, my father gave me a lovely old chess set. Didn't take much. I've got that chess set now, and I've played a lot with that, because I was a serious player once.
And do you still have the first book you bought?
I have indeed, most certainly. I've got them both in there. The one I found, The Story of the Solar System, the one I read first, and The Companion One, I've got those two, and the first one I bought, too.
Do they read very dated? Do they look very dated now?
They're obviously very dated. On the other hand, they were very good books at the time, and they are good fundamentally. Oh, yes. After all, that one published over 100 years ago now. Obviously, I mean, we've come a long way since then, but the basics are there, and it certainly taught me.
And you have a wonderful collection of books. Are all the books to do with astronomy?
Virtually all, I think. I have some cricket books too, but virtually astronomy. And they've all been very thoroughly read, except I've been given one or two in languages that I can't read. I mean, I can't read German, for example. If it's a language I can read, fair enough, but one or two I can't.
Patrick Moore, it's been a great pleasure to talk with you.
Well, nice
here
to see you.
And I hope you'll continue for many, many more years too.
Well, I'm 78 now. I can't have a lot longer, but I'll do my best anyway, and there are plenty of people coming after me. There's one sitting over there now.
And one other choice of music?
The March, Halley's Comet, written for the Halley's Comet Society. A society which has no aims, no objects, and no ambitions. It's the only completely useless society in the world, apart from the European Parliament, of course.